Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Guess what happened to me today?
What?
I got a free tattoo.
I could not believe it. The guy said, do you want a tattoo?
Just a random...
Opened up the side of his van.
No.
He said, it's for free. I said, sure.
We're going to need to get some frozen peas on that pronto, Josh.
Peas, check.
Unlike Rebel Wilson and Bridesmaids, we can't blame this week's top five on a guy in a van.
Though we could blame it on bad judgment.
Indeed we could. The topic, movie tattoos that we'd get if, I guess, we had to. Plus, a review of Godzilla.
The five tattoos we'd give Godzilla?
No, and not our five favorite Godzilla tattoos, either. Just a review.
All that and more ahead on Film Spotting.
This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including monthly subscription donors Les in Philadelphia, Taylor in Wilmette, Illinois, and Kathleen in Westfield, Massachusetts.
For more information about supporting the show, visit filmspotting.net and click on the Donate tab. And please help us reach more listeners by rating and reviewing the show on iTunes.
You're listening to Film Spotting. Don't tell our wives, but after the show, Josh and I are going to split a bottle of Jack Daniels and get ink for all of the picks that make this week's top five movie tattoos that we'd get. The shots, images, or movie dialogue, or some combination of those three that we love so much we might just undergo a painful procedure to make them a part of us forever. That's later in the show.
This is going to get weird, isn't it?
I think we're in uncharted weird territory here, Josh.
But first, critic David Ehrlich phones in to help us review the new Godzilla. The cool thing about my Godzilla tattoo, Adam, when I flex, it makes the tail swish back and forth.
Nice.
I want to talk to somebody in charge. You are not fooling anybody when you say that what happened was a natural disaster. You're lying. It was not an earthquake. It wasn't a typhoon. Because what's really happening is that you're hiding something out there. And it is going to send us back to the Stone Age.
So events conspired against me this week. We were planning to discuss Godzilla. Obviously, Josh, you've already seen it. I was hoping to see it this weekend. Didn't work out. So in order to keep this from being totally one-sided, we thought we would bring in a critic that we've wanted to get on the show for a while. He's only made brief appearances before. You've heard a voicemail or two at the end of the year, but here he is to share some more insights about Godzilla. He is freelance critic and contributor to The Dissolve and AV Club, among other outlets. David Ehrlich calling in from New York. How are you tonight, David?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you very much for having me.
Good to have you on, David.
Thanks for coming on. And we're going to focus on your Letterboxd comments to start. Letterboxd is the site that we're constantly espousing the virtues of here on the show. You wrote about it a little bit there. You wrote about it at much greater length and in more detail over at The Dissolve. We'll link to that in our show notes. But you'll see why, and I think listeners will see why we're going to focus on your Letterboxd comments, because it turns out You're a big fan of this movie, Godzilla. You started the review by simply saying, Godzilla is the truth. So here's a couple of quotes from you. One of the most satisfying, well-paced, and beautifully directed blockbusters since Jurassic Park, a genuine spectacle of humility. I almost feel like people have been conditioned to the explosive banality of contemporary temples, but if any 200 million monster movie is going to feel like a throwback, this is as fitting a choice as any. And now here's the really good stuff. At a certain point, I wanted the movie to stop, just so I could turn to the other people in the theater and be like, you guys, how effing wonderful is this? And they would have been like, dude, it's so effing wonderful, but I would also like to watch the rest of it now, please. So that voice, obviously, you know, you're putting out a voice there for Letterboxd, but it does reflect your unbridled enthusiasm for this film. So I'm curious, what expectations did you go in with, if any, and why is Godzilla the truth?
The expectations are concerned, I am very sort of militantly opposed to the hype machine that sort of defines really the year-round blockbuster calendar, but especially, you know, now that we're rolling into the summer. I saw the trailers for the film, which were artfully done and quite somber, and I was intrigued by the idea that they'd given such an enormous project to somebody who had only made a tiny movie, Gareth Edwards' previous only feature film, Monsters. And I was curious what the results would be, but I didn't really have any expectations, so to speak, beyond that. But what I found was, you know, a film that was obviously made by somebody who is definitely playing homage to Spielberg. He must have seen Jurassic Park. You know, he must have every frame of that movie memorized. But there's such an artfulness the way this movie was done. It really feels like they understood the character, and there's a real sense of scale, both in terms of, you know, not just in height, but in other dimensions as well, as far as the scale of the conflict, the relationship between the human characters, which, about which much has been said to the negative, and how sort of bland they are. But I think that the role that they play in the movie, really, as this sort of, their egocentrism, I think, is really their defining element. And I was really intrigued by how they and their stories are sort of usurped by these greater concerns as the movie goes on. I'll just say that to keep it vague. Mm-hmm. But I felt that there's a, if anything, I felt the movie, which felt so Spielbergian, really, for the most part, ended up being influenced more by Miyazaki than anything else. And the Japanese influence, of course, is right on. And I loved how they, you know, honored the Toho's original character and the Ishiro Honda film from 1954 and really not letting it deviate far from nuclear concerns and the environment, things of that nature.
Well, I'm not in the habit of reading any reviews before I see the movie myself, but since I hadn't seen this new Godzilla, which, as you mentioned, David, from Gareth Edwards' previous film, 2010, indie movie called Monsters, this new version stars Bryan Cranston, Juliette Binoche, of all actresses, is in this action movie spectacle as well, Aaron Taylor Johnson among the cast. But I did read your review, Josh, to help get me in the right frame of mind here. And if I'm not mistaken, the scale and the way the human characters are treated is, or not treated, are among the things you actually appreciated about the movie as well.
Yeah, I'm so glad we were able to have you on, David, because we're actually in lockstep on this. Not only our appreciation of the film, I think you probably like it a little bit more than me, but in terms of what resonated for
you
us.
You didn't have that internal dialogue?
No, I didn't turn to anybody in the theater at the time. But I was having a very good time during this film. And so it feels good to have a compatriot, especially because there has been some naysaying about the film and its characters in particular. But you're exactly right in that they are there to be maybe not humiliated. I like your phrase, a spectacle of humility, because that's dead on. But they are there to be put in their place by Godzilla, by this force of nature. And there's sadness to this film, very much. The first 20 minutes are rooted in sadness, I think. But there's also something amusing about how these characters become insignificant. And they try to have some sort of effect on Godzilla. You know, we try to use our technology in this movie, our smarts, you know, our human intellect, as opposed to the creature's intellect. That doesn't do anything. And the people are just helpless throughout this film. The scene that really jumped out to me that made this point is the one of Godzilla, probably about halfway through, because Edwards really holds back on showing us Godzilla. And this is in the ocean when Godzilla is swimming, and all we see is the creature's back, which is huge. The spikes are there coming out of the water, and it looks really like a moving island more than anything. And surrounding it is this fleet of American battleships. and they can't do anything but chug along and try to keep up. They're completely impotent in the face of this beast, and when Godzilla decides to dive under the water, all they can do is hang on, right, for dear life as a tsunami erupts. And the movie continues that way right through its climax of putting the people in their place, and I do think that was pointed. Now, the way we probably differ is that I think you see more intentionality in that in terms of how the characters are developed. They were developed well enough where I wasn't rolling my eyes during their scenes, but I don't think the human scenes necessarily elevated the movie. They could have. So I do see that criticism, but for me, you know, the fact that those may have been able to have been done a little bit better didn't detract what the movie is overall trying to do, which was really humble us in the audience with the awe of this creature.
I echo your sentiments verbatim. I do think that the film would not have hurt from having a more charismatic leading man rather than the character that Aaron Taylor-Johnson provides, or, you know, having some memorable lines of dialogue. Although I did, you know, Ken Watanabe's performance has caught some flack, and I rather enjoyed it. But I think that the scene that you mention and the scenes that immediately follow in its wake have a really tremendous way of communicating perspective. And that's really what I found most interesting in this movie, was about the very pointed and deliberate shift in perspective, and the way that you can feel sort of the movie uprooting itself from the human POV in the beginning towards a more objective POV. And it's done very much through the form of the film, through all of these incredible action sequences. One of the reasons that Godzilla is withheld and only seen in bits and pieces is because everything is seen from a person's POV. You don't see anything that would be impossible of one person to see until after it is sort of, there are various filters, you're seeing the characters through surveillance cameras, or you're watching the action on television. Eventually, in the final climactic battle, you get this grand, wide anime shot almost. It's lifted directly from Neon Genesis Evangelion, where you finally get this, you know, panoramic, objective POV, and you really feel as if you've been elevated from the human experience entirely. And I think that is really the major through line for the film for me, a much more convincing and compelling arc than any of the characters are provided, whether intentional or not.
And even when the humans come into play in that climax, they're again shown as insignificant. I think of the beautiful shot of Taylor Johnson as this Navy man, and he's on this specialized team at this point. They skydive down into the city of San Francisco as Godzilla is rampaging, and they go right by the creature. But instead of this being some sort of adventure moment for those people, we at this point recognize them as kind of like pesky fireflies for him. They're holding these flares in their hands, so it beautifully lights them up. But you also realize that from the creature's point of view, these are just gnats, and the creature barely even bothers with them. And I just thought that was a really great touch that the film hits upon a couple of times.
And the monsters, I mean, the morality that people bring into them, you know, Godzilla, is he a good guy or a bad guy? I think that at the end of the day, it always points more to our role in our responsibility and our culpability and why the monsters are fighting in the first place. And I think it's really interesting how the movie hones in, as I was mentioning Miyazaki earlier, on our sort of parasitic relationship with the environment, but how we always sort of put our needs first. And I think, again, going back to that idea of perspectives and the insignificance of the people, the movie slowly aligns us away from the evil monsters, you know, so to speak, and more towards Godzilla's point of view, until they're, again, formally, in how Edwards edits the climactic scene, our POV is really explicitly aligned with that of Godzilla. And so it feels like we are having this sort of like transcendental betterment over the course of the movie. But Godzilla remains a force of nature rather than a good guy or a bad guy. It's sort of we as a whole who learn something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, our culpability and what you're describing in terms of how we view Godzilla, I can't speak to obviously this film, but it sounds right in line with the original, which I just finally saw for the first time and really was impressed with. I had only seen maybe over the years as a kid the sequels to it and those kind of B movies, but you know, that movie is really phenomenal. And so if this one is following in that kind of wake, if it is being inspired by that, then it's certainly a movie
I think there are a lot of respectful nods to that original in this version, which I liked, without being a remake. You could tell that it was nodding to what that original movie was trying to do and doing similar things in its own way.
Well, Godzilla, the new Godzilla, is currently out in wide release. If you see it or have seen it and agree or disagree with Josh and David, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. Before we let you go, David, help us tease our top five movie tattoos that we might actually get. So first off, I have to ask, do you actually have any ink? And if you were inclined to get a movie-related tat, what would it be?
On the spot here. You don't yet.
I do not myself. But if I were inclined to get a movie-related tattoo, I think I would want something that was sort of future-proof. That was something I wouldn't grow out of, and that was representative of a lot of different things. And so I think the Criterion Collection C logo is very classy. And, you know, obviously, it's an umbrella for, you know, more than 700 different movies. And I know there are a number of people out there who have that.
Yes.
But I guess I have a friend who has Akira Kurosawa's handwritten title treatment for Ikiru, which translates as to live, across the bridge of their foot, which I always thought was nice and maybe a reminder as to what their priorities ought to be.
Uh-huh.
If you see that film, you might know what I mean by that. But yeah,
good picks there. And you're right, I don't know how many people have the Criterion C, but we did get an email from one of our listeners who definitely does have that tattoo. David Ehrlich, people can find you on Twitter at David Ehrlich. Am I correct?
You are indeed.
We'll link to that in our show notes, as well as some of your stuff over the AV Club and the Dissolve. And am I right that listeners can also find you on a podcast or two that you do?
Yes. You can find me on a podcast that was formerly known as Operation Kino, but is now known as Fighting in the War Room.
Great title.
And it's located at fightinginthewarroom.com.
David, again, great to have you on. Let's do it again sometime.
Thanks, David.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up for Massacre Theater, Adam and I perform a scene speaking only in Godzilla roars. Can't be worse than some of my accents. Then I'll have a brief review of The Double with Jesse Eisenberg in a dual performance. Stay with us.
Your nice little pictures, Mr. Turner.
You'd make a fine subject for you to paint.
Oh, is that so? I shall cogitate upon it.
When I experience a masterpiece such as yours, I'm struck by the clarity with which you have captured the moment.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. The 12-day Cannes Film Festival wraps up this weekend. One of the early standouts from the fest was Mike Leigh's latest. You heard a clip from the trailer there. Mr. Turner, a biopic of one of Britain's greatest artists, 19th century painter J.M.W. Turner. Turner is played in the film by a Mike Leigh regular, Timothy Spall. Next week on the show, we'll get a report on Cannes from our friend Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, who enjoyed a fortnight or so at the festival.
Been too long since Michael's been on the show.
It has been a little while. He had that month-long run, and now we've tried to build up that desire to get Michael back on the show. I think it's out there among Film Spotting listeners. He's going to come by and share his thoughts on the new X-Men movie starring my guys, Michael Fassbender and James McAvoy. Right now, though, it's time for some acting that will be nowhere near the caliber of Fassbender and McAvoy. Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time, Adam and I massacred this scene.
I got a job for you.
Well, if pay's right and it's legal, I'll do it.
It's not strictly legal.
Well, pay's right, I'll do it.
It's in reference to that gentleman and my wife. The more I think about it, the more irritated I get.
Huh? Could you tell me what it is you want me to do, or is it a secret?
It's no joke.
You want me to kill him?
Well, what? What do you think?
You're an idiot.
So this won't interest you, huh?
I didn't say that. All I said was you're an idiot.
That was M. Emmett Walsh as Lauren Visser and Dan Hedaya as Julian Marty in Blood Simple from 1984, written and directed, of course, by the Coen brothers.
On Film Spotting episode 489, we reviewed Blue Ruin, a very good new revenge thriller, very much indebted to the Coen brothers and their classic debut film. Also on that show, our summer movie preview. If you want to hear that episode, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or find the show at filmspotting.net. Got some feedback from listeners here, Josh, many of them taken with your Emmett Walsh impression. We'll see what Pat Galvin in Anchorage, Alaska says. Emmett Walsh is a treasure, even when brutalized by Josh.
Hey, now.
Now, that was an anomaly, I'm going to say. Blood Simple changed the way I watch films, also caused me to change majors in college to a double major, including video production. Not that I did anything with it.
We also heard from P.J. Bentley in Portland, Oregon. Seriously, Josh's M. Emmett Walsh was so good it gave it away.
There you
now
go.
That is more like it.
Yeah, that was the norm. Michael Gruhl in Flensburg, Germany, all the way in Germany, gave us these connections to that show. This time you massacred one of the greatest scenes from the Coen brothers' debut film, Blood Simple. The obvious tie-in is that Josh mentioned Blood Simple as an influence to the reviewed film, Blue Ruin.
A little bit of a clue there, I guess.
Also, both are indie thrillers with a two-word title that starts with the letter B.
Very nice.
Sometimes it's just that simple, Josh. It's just that simple.
Matt Peterson from Hawthorne, California wrote in, both Blood Simple and Blue Ruin are informed by noir aesthetic, and both feature less than intelligent protagonists murderously bent on revenge.
Yeah, that pretty much sums it up.
I don't know. Is the protagonist of Blue Ruin, Dwight, is he less than intelligent?
Not necessarily.
I got the feeling he was a smart guy, just made some bad decisions.
Yeah, and he's in over his head.
That's
and
for sure.
Both protagonists, I think we can say that of. Why don't you go ahead and reach into the Film Spotting hat, Josh, and pick out this week's winner.
The winner is Patrick Madigan from right here in Chicago.
Congratulations, Patrick. Email feedback at filmspotting.net to claim your very own Film Spotting t-shirt.
What happened to the cannoli line?
Rex,
you're supposed to say forget about it, Sanchez. The old man likes his cannoli.
Look, I made a mistake, all right? It didn't make any difference anyway.
Hey, I'm letting it go. But don't say it doesn't matter. Every line matters.
Well, after that quite impressive M. Emmett Walsh impression, we're going to really put your accent work to the test this week, Josh.
Giving me a challenge.
We are indeed. I'm looking forward to it. I pretty much am doing what I always do. I'm just playing the straight man here, and I think I can handle that. We are going to change the name here in the scene so as to not give it away, though by altering the name, we'll probably give you a little bit of a hint.
We may even be giving it away.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that most listeners will be able to identify the connection to this week's show. So,
oh, you know what? We could do a prop here, too.
We could.
Yeah, I've got it right here.
Oh, I love it when we do prop work.
I know.
Okay. We get our fully recording work out of the way.
Make it a little complicated here, kind of like juggling, but.
Wow. He does accent work and the props.
I know.
That's how talented Josh Larson is. Are you ready? You're going to start it off.
All right.
And action.
Free as a bird, apparently. You go wherever you want with whomever. That much freedom could maybe get a fellow in trouble. What do you think?
I'd like my keys.
Could be y'all remember me?
Oh, yeah, sure. I remember you. You were at the movie house the other night.
Oh, I'm disappointed. I'm hurt.
I would like my keys.
Root Republican. You look the same. Maybe 15 pounds heavier. But they say the average man gains a pound a year till he's about...
Oh, come on.
Gains a pound a year till he's about 60. Me? I dropped a pound every year of my sentence.
Atlanta, 77.
You got it. July. 14 years since I held a set of keys.
And scene. I don't know what it says that the keys were the best actor in the scene.
That's probably
the most dramatic, heavy lifting was done by those keys, which were in your hand.
They did all the work.
Well,
I don't know who was holding them, but.
No, that scene was not Forrest Gump. So don't send that in, even though that's what Josh sounded like. A psychopathic Forrest Gump. If you know what scene we just brutally massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback at filmspotting.net. Your deadline, Monday, June 2nd.
I'm going to keep these keys, too, because I drove, so that's how we'll get home. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the show in 2 weeks. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
I'd like to introduce everyone to our newest coworker. Please welcome James Simon.
Have you spoken to the new employee?
James? Yeah, sure, I met him.
But did you notice anything strange about him? I mean, did he remind you of anyone?
Who did you have in mind?
What'll it be?
I'll just have a Coke.
A Coke. And you?
Scrambled eggs.
I don't serve breakfast in the evening.
Well, do you still have eggs here?
Yeah.
And do you have a frying pan?
Yeah.
Then give me the damn food.
Time for everybody's favorite segment on the show, despite the fact that it doesn't have a catchy jingle. Larson recommends. Doesn't really have a catchy title.
I was just
going
to say, the name isn't doing
maybe
much for it.
That's
anyway
why there isn't a song to go with it. Jesse Eisenberg, in that scene you just heard from the trailer for The Double, it's from director Richard Ayoade. He is the filmmaker responsible for his debut movie, Submarine, came out in 2010. Not widely seen, I think it's fair to say, Josh, but widely adored by the people who did see it. The Double also stars Mia Wasikowska and Wally Shawn. It's playing in select cities, but it can also be seen via cable on demand, and you can download it from iTunes, which is what I've done. I've got a fairly long flight coming up in a few days, and I've saved it for that. I would ask you if you recommend it as being worth my time and our listeners' time, but, well, we know what the name of the segment is. So tell us why you recommend The Double.
I'm really curious to see how you respond to this, actually, because I don't know. I could see you going either way pretty strongly.
It basically looks like Dostoevsky does Brazil.
That's a good description.
Okay.
With a fair amount of Kafka thrown in, too.
I like Kafka.
But the, you know, Ayoade does give it its own, despite all of those influences, he does give it its own feel and a comedic flair, even though there's a lot of depressing elements to the movie, too. It is actually based on a Dostoevsky novella called The Double. So that's the prominent theme. But in plotting, you feel a lot of Kafka because Eisenberg plays this office drone, and there's a lot of time spent on the absurdity of this office he works on and the bureaucracy, the hoops he has to jump through just to get through security every day. Largely that's because he's this guy who has no real personality. He lets people step all over him. He's shy. He doesn't have the courage to pursue the girl played by Wasikowska, who also works with him. Then this double shows up who looks like him and, of course, is the opposite, you know, cocky, throws his weight around, has no problem talking to anybody, really. So they play this largely for laughs, and I found a lot of absurd humor in it that worked for me. Really what stood out to me overall with this movie was the production design, and that's where the Brazil references come into. There are just some great touches. The first shot we see of him is in this subway that looks like it's at once a steampunk thing from the past and made up of all these inventions that have yet to be devised yet. It's a little bit of the future, too. And a lot of the movie has this. There are wonderful touches like the air vents over each office worker's desk is just ginormous. I mean, unnecessarily huge. It looks like it could suck them up as much as it could provide them with relief. And so there are a lot of touches like that in the movie that did carry me through. Eisenberg is good. You know, he's not doing anything really shocking. It's kind of one of those given roles where you know he's got to play this guy this one way, the other guy the other way. So there's nothing really amazing to the performance, but I did like him. Wasikowska is so good, as she often is, that it made me think, why don't we get one of these movies where the female character has the doppelganger?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a little familiar in this idea of we have to watch this guy work through his social anxiety, and she's the object of him doing that. And it might have been more interesting if it was flipped, but that's not the movie they made. So what they did give us, I think, is pretty good. Again, predominantly the production design, the art design is what stood out to me enough so that it wasn't a Gilliam. It almost goes completely Gilliam, but it's not a copycat. It does have its own flair. Really, the recent movie that came to mind most was Wrist Cutters, a love story. I don't know if you remember that or saw it.
We reviewed it here on the show.
Okay.
Not favorably.
Not favorably. Yeah, that I did like that film. It has a little bit. So this will be interesting to see how you respond then to The Double, because it has a little bit of that melancholy feel and how suicide actually comes into play in this movie as well. I think it juggles all that in an interesting way.
Well, I'm certainly on board with any film that may feature dual Mia Wasikowskas. At the very least, though, you are saying that two Jesse Eisenbergs is better than two Jake Gyllenhaals.
In my mind, I know. I tried to stay away from that comparison.
It's the year of the doppelganger.
It is. They're very different films in a lot of ways. So, but it is hard not to make that inevitable comparison. I tried not to do it while watching the
movie.
And
I had to bring it up.
No, thanks a lot.
Well, The Double, like I said, is out in select cities, but is playing on demand and via iTunes. And I am catching up with it, as I mentioned, here in a few days. So maybe on an upcoming show or in bonus content, we can see if our views are in line with each other.
All right, Adam, are you sure you want to go through with this? If you change your mind after you list the movie-related tattoos you'd be willing to get, it's going to be very painful to remove that list from the Film Spotting website.
Good point.
All right, then. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Hey there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. Matt Singer here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And on the latest episode of SVU, guest host Mike Ryan and I review the second highest grossing film of 1986, a movie that, adjusted for inflation, outgrossed both 2001 A Space Odyssey and Psycho, Crocodile Dundee. Plus, inspired by everyone's favorite knife-wielding Australian, we'll recommend some other fish-out-of-water movies you can rent or stream at home right now. It's going to be funnier than a banana in the tailpipe. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
This is Colin Trevorrow, the director of Safety Not Guaranteed, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
I know you've been out.
What?
You've been out of your room.
No, I haven't.
Paul, my little ceramic penguin in the study always faces due south.
I don't know what you're talking about. Ceramic penguin.
Is this what you're looking for?
Well, if that scene from 1990's Misery with Kathy Bates and James Caan doesn't evoke a specific image, let me help you out. Bates as Annie Wilkes, in close-up, holding a butcher knife up to her face, staring down at Caan, who's strapped down in a bed. Now imagine encountering that image, tattooed on someone's leg. Yes, it's top five time. This week, we're sharing the top five movie tattoos that we'd get. Kathy Bates, Josh, I'm going to guess not making your list?
No, I thought about her, but I decided to go with Richard Farnsworth from Misery.
A deep cut. I like it. That Misery tattoo was among those that Film Spotting listeners sent in. We got an email from listener Franco Asmail. I hope I'm saying that right. Longtime listener, I believe, in San Francisco. He submitted it, which is, according to him, a friend's tattoo.
Sure, Franco. A friend. Uh-huh.
If you want to see that tattoo and be terrified by it, plus more listener ink, go to our producer, one of our producers, Sam Van Halgren, his Tumblr. It's samvanhalgren.tumblr.com. And you can also find a link to that in our show notes, but we've been collecting them there. There's four or five that have already been posted from last week. And by the time you hear the show and visit, you'll see even more. A lot of stuff, a lot of good stuff.
This whole topic really has been generated by listeners, right?
That's true. And they've really responded as well. But we did initially get this idea from some listener comments back on episode 488. A few weeks ago, we read some poll feedback from Joshua Carell in Portland, Oregon. It was in response to one of our death matches. We pitted Jim Jarmusch versus John Sayles, and he defended his Jarmusch pick by saying, I've got a tattoo of Eva's cassette player from Jarmusch's right. Stranger Than Paradise, and I think you joked that basically we should commit to our picks in such a fashion and get tattoos. And I threw out, listeners, if you've got a tattoo, we want to see them. Well, one listener took that even a step further. Kyle in Albuquerque wrote in.
Hey, Adam and Josh, just listened to episode 488 and heard about the guy with the tattoo. Instead of getting your top five lists tattooed, how about using that as a top five topic? Top five movies that you would tattoo on your body. And what would the tattoo be? Thanks for the show, guys.
So I teased this a little bit last week, and I mentioned that when I first got that email from Kyle, my response was, that's brilliant. It's such a good idea, but also so absurd and ridiculous that there's no way we're going to do it. It would just be too hard and, well, it would just be too hard, frankly. And then the more I thought about it, I realized that
not only could we do it, if we really put our minds to it, we should do it, Josh.
You're
still moral
thinking
imperative.
About making lists, not getting tattoos, right?
Well, let's see how the lists go.
Okay.
I think we could end up there. But I thought this was one of those very personal lists, which are always the best top fives. So it could rival the Sight and Sound, where we named our top 10 favorite films, basically, of all time, or what we did on our 400th show, the live episode, where we did the top five things we learned from the movies. These
right.
are picks that nobody can really write in and say, you got it wrong. How did you forget this? Everyone's going to have a unique list. So we're going to get to our list here in a minute. But if we go back to Joshua from Portland, it is funny because after hearing Kyle's email on last week's show, we got an email from him. And it turns out he's actually gone and done what we surely almost will only talk about doing. He chose an icon from each of his five favorite films and got them tattooed right in a line from wrist to elbow. So if you want to see that, that again is over at Sam's Tumblr page.
It's really something.
It
impressive.
Is. So plenty of inspiration from listeners, and we are getting a lot of comments with ideas and pictures, and we love it when we get that kind of response where we really see the passion that you have to have for a movie in order to put it on your body forever. So with that, Josh, that brings us to our list. You were initially a little bit hesitant, a little bit unsure of the topic, but I think you had a little bit of a breakthrough.
I did have a breakthrough, and my number five is where it came, actually. Sam suggested to me when I was saying how difficult this was, he suggested, come on, this is easy. How about an umbrella for the Umbrellas of Cherbourg?
Yeah.
That's director Jacques Demy's 1964 attempt to out musical, the Hollywood musical. It stars Catherine Deneuve and Nino Castelnuovo as young lovers who are interrupted by the Algerian War. So, yeah, makes sense. I did name it on that Sight and Sound top 10 of all time list we made. But does it really mean enough to me to get a tattoo of it on my body? You know, when Sam mentioned, I understood why, but I don't know. Is it that personal of a film? Well, then I remembered that Singing in the Rain, duh, also prominently features an umbrella in
yeah.
its most famous scene.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again.
So suddenly the umbrella tattoo idea, you know, becomes not only a nod to two of the all-time great musicals, but also to the entire genre. And musicals, you know, it's a genre that my Star Wars-loving preteen self would never have cared for or even really considered, right? It was grandma's genre or something
uh-huh.
like that. But it's one of those that as I've gotten more into film and started to explore different types and periods and so forth, I've really come to appreciate it. It's one of my favorite genres as a movie mad grown-up. So this umbrella tattoo would also be something like a nod to broadening of horizons or maybe the film journey I've taken a little bit. I think Sam was onto something there. And the umbrella tattoo would be my number five, tying it in with Umbrellas of Cherbourg and Singing in the Rain. Now,
okay.
we didn't discuss this, but I gave this some thought too, where each of these are going to go.
I thought about it a little bit as well.
Good. I think I'm going to go lower back for this one. So
lower back?
Yeah. Start at the lower back.
It's a tramp stamp of an umbrella.
Of an umbrella. Well, maybe off to the side. I think then it's not a tramp stamp, right?
Well, I took this list very seriously, Josh, because as we said, it's so personal. And the Pantheon, in fact, was eligible for it because we're thinking about these films that have so much meaning for us. We have to consider the movies that we've locked away
yeah.
as being among our favorite of all time. It turns out none of my picks come from our Pantheon, but one of them, my number two pick, was a contender at one point to be anointed and surely will be again at some point. And it made an appearance on my penalty box as well because it had come up a few times. So we'll get to that. But one of the things I really wrestled with, and I think I found sort of a happy medium with my picks, is whether or not I was going to go with images or words
mm-hmm.
or a combination of both. And I was really pushing myself to pick images because it's a visual medium. But I was arguing about that with our producer, Sam, and he said, of course it's a visual medium, but quotes are the currency of movie conversation. Movie image tattoos invariably seem too explicit to me. Movie quotes are like a secret code with film lovers, which I think is really well expressed. And I think there's some truth to it, but I did want to find a balance. I wanted to focus first on images over text and see if I could maybe combine them a little bit. And the fact is, even though quotes are the currency of movie conversation, so are great images. Sometimes
sure.
there's something really wonderful about being able to put up just a still frame from a film that doesn't explicitly have a character in it and know that someone else next to you knows exactly what you're talking about. You can have that kind of bond over movie images. I also thought about this in the realm, Josh. We've been joking about whether or not we're actually going to get any of these tattoos. I at least wanted to force myself. I had to give myself some stakes to this top five. And this really had to be not just theoretical. It had to be a case where I could actually envision myself going to do this. So it really had to mean something to me personally. And after I made my picks, I went back and realized that there was sort of an unofficial memorial list pick here for my top five. And I guess I could call it The Knight Plays Chess with Death, or The Dance of Death, could go with either image from Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal. It doesn't apply to all of my picks, but it is a theme. And I guess for me, it's the theme, mortality, the reckoning with the mystery and meaning of our existence. And that's appropriate because tattoos are supposed to last forever. They're emblems of permanence that underscore our impermanence because they last only as long as our bodies do. They also speak to the fundamental human desire to leave a mark, to say, this is what I stood for before we shuffle off this mortal coil. So it only did seem fitting that a lot of my picks wrestled with this. Which brings us finally to my number five pick. It's inspired by the movie Never Let Me Go, my favorite film of 2010, based on the Kazuo Ishiguro novel. And for those who haven't seen it, I won't spoil anything. Maybe the plot description, the simple synopsis from IMDb says it best when it talks about three friends who come of age at a mysterious secluded boarding school and they're destined to lead brief lives. The line that my tattoo is going to be taken from is a line that is basically lifted right out of the novel. It's where in the movie, Carey Mulligan, our main character throughout most of the film, our eyes to this world, she says, I remind myself I was lucky to have had any time with him at all.
What I'm not sure about is if our lives have been so different from the lives of the people we save. We all complete. Maybe none of us really understand what we've lived through. Or feel we've had enough time.
So that phrase, we all complete, that's something that really had a profound impact on me. And I suppose it's just on its face mysterious and deep sounding. It's the kind of phrase, if someone saw it on your body, they'd want to hear the story behind it, or in lieu of an obvious explanation, it's something they would ponder. The word complete is really the key. It has a specific meaning in the universe of this story, if you've seen the film, but it's fairly clear what she's referring to. It's inevitable that we are going to degrade and die. But there's something about the word complete that doesn't make it seem so terrifying and miserable, right? It makes it seem natural and acceptable, which is how I'd like death to seem anyway. And there's, of course, something unifying and humanistic about that phrase as well. It says no matter our differences, no matter the specifics of our lives and our deaths, we all have the same laments. And that's a very beautiful thought to me. So I'm not sure if I would just go with that phrase, or I would go with that phrase and maybe some image from the film. There's that great poster shot, which has Andrew Garfield and Carey Mulligan running along Clevedon Pier. It's in Somerset, England. Just a very beautiful, evocative image. Or the trinkets, the toys we see in the movie,
right,
where these kids at the school, it's their big sort of jamboree where all of a sudden someone shows up with these old castaway toys that clearly have been used and not really loved at all. And for them, it's so meaningful and such an important day. And I always loved the symbolism of that because these kids see these knickknacks that seem to be valueless but are invaluable to them. And there's this notion that anything matters as long as somebody cares about it, if someone assigns value to it. And that is another aspect of the book that really stuck with me. So Never Let Me Go.
Is it going to be the text? You got to pick one.
That would be the lead.
Text. Okay.
I would start with the text and maybe try to build an image around it.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wrestled with that too, whether to go with text or images. I ended up choosing all images. So considered a few texts, but went all images. So my number four actually is a logo and combination of text and image, I guess. It comes from a Wes Anderson film because I wanted to choose something from one of his pictures because he's probably my favorite working filmmaker, as listeners well know. And really, there's no shortage of options when you're starting to think about this. Speaking of text, I could have gone with I Save Latin from Rushmore or something like that. An image might be the silhouette of the wolf giving the fist pump at the end of Fantastic Mr. Fox. I love that image. Maybe even a bottle rocket where it all started. Or Steve Zissou's submarine. You know, a nice nod to the Beatles there, too. So it works.
I sense a couple sleeve coming ways. On. A full Wes Anderson sleeve, Josh.
You could go many, many directions. I narrowed in on one that Anderson has already given us because he's so fussy. He likes these sorts of things like logos and scripts and that sort of thing. And so we have the Team Zissou logo, that grouping of Z's from The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. I do think this is representative of one of the things that resonates with me about his films, too, though. They so often deal with this sense of belonging to a group that needs or wants something like a logo, right? Or a motto or some symbol of their togetherness. Almost all of his groups have that. And really, just about every one of his films, except, interestingly, you could argue maybe The Grand Budapest Hotel doesn't do this, but most of his films are about the creating or sustaining or restoring of a community. I also do like choosing something from The Life Aquatic because I get the sense that what seems to separate an Anderson fan from an Anderson fanatic is whether or not you go for this movie. It's kind of a tipping point movie.
Mm-hmm.
And to choose something from an Anderson film, too, feels to me, from everything on this list, more in line with how you should get a tattoo, okay? Because I'm in the midst of the fandom right now. I'm not necessarily looking back on something I've appreciated for a long time. And I feel like that's when people do get a lot of tattoos. And there could be a downside to this because maybe they're going to put out, say, a really terrible album. The next album's going to be horrible, and you're going to regret that tattoo. Maybe Anderson's got a horrible film ahead of him. I'll be stuck with my tattoo, but that's okay. That's kind of how they should work.
Yeah,
so.
No, that's a great point, and I'm guessing there's someone out there listening who's going to email us not only a Wes Anderson tattoo, which actually we've already seen that.
Yeah. The Royal Tenenbaums.
Kenny
one.
Meyer
yeah.
with his uh-huh. Tenenbaums, Margot and Richie, but there's got to be a Team Zissou tattoo.
I'm sure.
Out there.
Maybe,
right.
maybe where I'm going to put it, on upper arm, you know, just below the shoulder. So.
You're right, though, that to do something like this, they have to be timeless. There has to be something timeless about them.
That's versus, your hope, right?
Right. Versus picking something that you could really change your mind about 2 weeks or 2 years later. So good pick. Even though I'm one of those people, I think that's well said, who maybe that movie does separate me as just a Wes Anderson fan and not a full-blown fanatic. My number four tattoo that I might actually get is the image of Alain Delon and his fedora from Le Samurai.
Oh, good.
The Jean-Pierre Melville film. If you've seen the Criterion Collection cover image, it's Delon as Jeff Costello in profile, and he's got his finger touching the tip of his hat. This, for me, Josh, is my aspirational tattoo. See, not all my picks are going to be totally focused on death and really kind
but,
of
but that's what I was going to say. Tattoos, a lot
there.
Of times, are the guy you want to be.
The guy you want to
right?
be. That's so. Exactly what this is. It's the tattoo I want because it's cool. And there's nobody cooler to me in the history of cinema than Alain Delon from Le Samurai. I could never look like him. I could never carry myself like him. But I would love, Josh, to be the strong, silent, mysterious type. Always calm and in control. Never outwardly vulnerable. Someone who reads people rather than wearing all of his emotions on his sleeve like I tend to do and constantly expressing whatever's on my mind at any given moment. All that is what I do aspire to be and probably never will come close. I also love that he's a professional, someone who is really good at what he does, and those characters are among my favorite to watch on screen. This is a film, Le Samurai, that was discussed on the show maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I think it was a listener's choice pick. If you haven't seen it, but you've seen Ghost Dog, the Jim Jarmusch film, you'll see a lot of similarities, clearly an influence on Jarmusch. As I think back on that Jeff Costello character, his life of solitude and ultimately tragedy isn't one I really want to emulate, or do I think most people want to emulate? But as a visage of cool, it's tough to beat. And I think if I was going to get it, I'd probably get it on my arm, right up there by my shoulder, and basically would be facing out.
Right. Yeah. That makes sense. Well, my number three, I should probably point out, is not an aspirational tattoo because it's the Blue Fairy from Pinocchio. And my mind went here because Pinocchio is another sight and sound type list pick that I made, top 10 film of all time for me. It was also my number one traditionally animated film when we did that list a while back. So the pick feels right, but it also forced me to consider really consider why I respond to animation so strongly, why it does seem to speak to me in a special way. And I think part of it is, you know, it's just purely because it's something I'm incapable of doing myself. I've never been able to draw, so I'm in awe of that sort of artistry. But I do also think that animation best captures the sense of wonder that first drew me to the movies and continues to sustain my passion for them. It's probably also why I'm more eager to embrace whimsy or fantasy, films like that. I mean, animation, it just seems to, it simply has more possibility than live action, at least in my mind. Anything can happen. And that's even really the case for stories that you know, even though we know this tale of Pinocchio, a part of the delight is seeing how the animators are going to envision this wild tale.
As I live and breathe, a fairy.
Good Geppetto. You have given so much happiness to others. You deserve to have your wish come true. Little puppet made of pine, wake. The gift of life is thine.
What they can't do these days.
All right, so now why the blue fairy? In particular from Pinocchio, well, if you're going to go with a woman figure, which is a common tattoo direction, she's more my tattoo style than something like, you know, a topless mermaid or something like that. Not really what I'm looking for. Plus there's the...
Are you a sailor, Josh?
Yeah, exactly. Nope, never been a sailor. Plus there's the bonus fact with the Blue Fairy, though, that she has a cameo in Steven Spielberg's best film, what might be his best film. Still not positive about that, but AI, artificial intelligence, is certainly up there. So with a blue fairy tattoo, I get a Spielberg tip of the hat as well. Probably put this one on my other arm, just below the shoulder. Are you
nice.
Getting a visual here,
I am.
Adam?
Okay. It's really coming through loud and clear. You're listening to Film Spotting. If it's not clear what kind of madness we're up to here, we're sharing the top five movie tattoos in parentheses, that we might get. And it's probably the weirdest top five we've ever done in now almost 500 shows, but I honestly believe it might be our most fun as well. Certainly the most revealing. It's among them.
This is going to happen all the time when we completely run out of top five topics.
True.
It's all going to be this sort of stuff.
Well, my number three, a nice balance of sorts in response to my number four pick. We go from the coolest character in cinema, Alain Delon from Le Samurai, to the uncoolest, William Miller with his microphone from Cameron Crowe's Almost Famous. And I would use some form of that phrase, that conversation he has with Philip Seymour Hoffman's Lester Bangs, when he tells him the only true currency in this bankrupt world is what you share with someone when you're uncool.
I'm glad you were home.
I'm always home. I'm uncool.
Whether it's that phrase, the uncool, or we are uncool, I would incorporate that somehow, but I would use that image as well. And for people who have been following us on Twitter for a while or go to the Film Spotting Facebook page, this isn't a surprise. They know that I've had this image for years as my avatar. Going back to the very first message board I was ever on, probably in 2001 or 2002. So not an aspirational pick, not the man, not the character I want to be, but more like the character I actually am. And part of my choosing this and going with this for so many years as I have is, as I have noted a million times here on the show, it is the first movie I ever reviewed, Almost Famous. It was purely by accident. It just happened to open the weekend I started writing reviews for the Daily Iowan. So there is that sentimental attachment to it. I loved the movie when it came out. Part of it, though, is also that it does represent me, I think. It's the guy with the microphone trying to express himself, trying to get others to express themselves. And I got into movies with the same passion William Miller gets into music, where he has a breakthrough, he has an epiphany, and he just becomes obsessed with it. I became fascinated as well by not just art of all kinds, but specifically artists and the creative process around the same age William is in the movie, and with the same fervor. That fascination and passion is what that smile on his face, if you know the image I'm talking about, it's just as he leans in to interview Russell at the end of Almost Famous. That's what that represents for me, that leaning forward even. It reflects his curiosity. This isn't a passive thing for him. It's very active. He's an engaged learner, and he just wants to know as much as he can. I, of course, agree with the sentiment as well, so eloquently expressed by Lester Bangs there. So maybe what I do, Josh, actually, this occurred to me, is maybe on my right arm, I've got Le Samurai, and I've got William Miller on the other.
There you go.
So it's not love and hate. right? Like Robert Mitchum in Night of the Hunter. Yeah. But I've got cool and uncool.
All right.
I to like keep it. Me in check at all times.
You know what's good about that, though? A tattoo should also be a time marker, maybe, or an event marker.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, to mark that first review and that it lined up so well. I'm not going to do that because my first published review was of Interview with a Vampire. And I don't need a pasty Brad Pitt on my body. No, thanks.
Oh, I'd love to see that.
All right. Number two is Balthazar the Donkey from Alhazard Balthazar.
You called this one.
You did. You went there right away. It came to my mind right away. Yeah, you've got me pegged. It is my favorite Bresson film. It's the one that speaks to the sort of religious wrestling that defines his movies and does make him such a continually rich cinematic figure for me. And the wrestling is what is key. I mean, Bresson's movies, they're more questions than answers. Mm-hmm. I feel like after we did that marathon is what stood out to me. Sometimes they're really angry questions. I mean, these movies certainly would not make for good testimonials. But it's the asking that means so much to me, especially when it's done as jarringly and artfully as it is in Bresson's, really stark elemental films. So A Tattoo of Balthazar, it kind of would be this continual reminder of that sometimes asking the questions can be more important than having the answers even. So if I chose a shot from this, I'm thinking it might be the one of Balthazar's head when he's wearing the crown of flowers that Marie makes for him. Obviously, there's all sorts of Christian implications to that image as well. So this one, I'm going to probably put this one on my shoulder, on my back.
Okay. I love it.
Okay.
Yeah, I did know it was coming, but it's inspired even if people would just think you're a diehard Democrat.
That's true. We'll have to somehow
could
make
be misleading.
That distinction clear. Possibly those flowers will do it.
My number two is the first one I thought about. It's the only one I had for about a week when we first agreed to focus on this topic. And I thought it was going to be my number one, and something just edged it out at the last minute. And as I look back at my list here real quick, I'm guessing if you did some Google image searches, you're going to find a few almost famous related tattoos out there. Probably not completely unheard of. Probably a few Le Samurai. Maybe not any Never Let Me Go tattoos. That might be
I think you've got that
unique.
One.
But sure enough, I knew if I Googled this, it would return a bunch of results, and it did. It's from the movie Blade Runner, the Tears in Rain soliloquy, delivered by Roy Batty, of course, played by Rutger Hauer at the end of that film. If you Google it or go to Tumblr, you'll find all sorts of combinations of that phrase, Tears in Rain. Some people have the whole soliloquy somewhere on their body, or they combine that with the face of Roy Batty. It is the ultimate validation of his humanity. And he's, of course, not a human. He's a replicant. But nevertheless, that is what he's expressing and exposing there. His dying is that expression. And that speech is his testimony. His audience, if you will, is basically bearing witness to his remarkable life. And it's ultimately the validation that he made some kind of mark in this world. It's almost a model, he suggests, I think, to strive for, while also being understandably wistful and melancholy.
I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. Time to die.
There's no better death speech.
Just
final words
just
on screen.
Just don't go with time to die and nothing else.
No, I would probably end on
different.
Tears in Rain.
There you go.
I'm pretty bleak here, Josh, but I'm going to go with Tears in Rain. It's just so wonderfully evocative. What are sea beams? Why would they be glittering? What's the Tannhauser Gate? These are things that should be meaningless and essentially are to us. The Tannhauser Gate's not a place we have any attachment to, but we don't need it. They simply sound wondrous and beautiful. And that Tears in Rain simile is so perfect. Of course, you can't distinguish tears from raindrops on someone's face, just as these moments that he describes in the grand scheme of time are indistinguishable from others and are inconsequential. But what else do we have to strive for but those types of experiences, to do something that is of consequence? That's what that speech, not just summing up that existential dilemma so well, as I believe it does, and so eloquently, but also giving us kind of a path, giving us some kind of model to strive for. That's what's always stuck out to me with that.
Yeah, and this is one I think you do go with a text where
has to be
it works better than the images, actually, mm-hmm. because if Scott didn't feel the need to image what's being spoken, you know, why should you with a tattoo of it? So.
Absolutely.
Okay, number one time, and my number one is actually the only tattoo I've ever really considered getting, albeit a long, long time ago.
Well, let's just be honest with our listeners. I mean, we are going and getting these tattoos, right?
We are.
That's what this list was all about.
Now you say it.
Yeah. I mean, you're locked into this, Josh. As soon as you say it's done.
See what our number ones or the whole list? Are we going five through one down
the
arm?
Just the number ones. Hey, if you're not going to put it all on the line, you got to have some stakes here, Josh.
You haven't opened the Jack Daniels yet even.
That's true.
All right. It's going to be a silhouette of a Joshua Tree from U2's Joshua Tree album. Now, the movie I'm tying this to, of course, is Rattle and Hum.
Really?
Yeah. Well, it comes from the Joshua Tree, but that concert film documented their Joshua Tree tour. So even though it resulted in its own Rattle and Hum albums, for me, this works. Now, why did I consider this tattoo? It was around college time. Well, keep in mind that I was 13 when Joshua Tree came out in 1987. So I was just really getting into music at that point. So this album was mind-blowing for me. And then being at that age and being able to discover U2's earlier stuff, getting to experience something like Octoon Baby, you know, firsthand, all of that solidified my connection to the band. And then as I got older, the way U2 and mostly Bono really managed faith and popular culture was really formative for me. He's really one of those rarities. I think of people like Mavis Staples or even someone like Stephen Colbert, maybe, who's managed to create this space where the two things fruitfully inform each other. They don't seem to be at odds at all. Now, Rattle and Hum, you scoffed at my pick of that film because it doesn't have the reputation as the greatest concert movie
ever.
Well,
I scoffed actually because I just got done listening to the audiobook of one of Chuck Klosterman's collection of essays. I think it was I Wear the Black Hat. And I don't remember the context of why Rattle and Hum came up, but he just eviscerates it line.
It didn't impress the critics when it came out. But this is also going back to fandom. And for me, having that connection with the band, coming to know the music at that point in my life, the film is secondary,
yes.
You know, and it's one of those instances where I don't know if I'd even want to watch it again now that I'm, you know, a supposedly sophisticated adult who critiques film. You know, it would be a different experience. Mm-hmm. And I want to hold on to that experience that I had at that time and what it meant for me. So
okay.
This will be my number one, maybe a little bit of a cheat here. Probably, you know, the back of the neck. There's no covering this one up, Adam. So it's going to go right there.
All right, that brings us to my number one, the tattoo I like so much, I think I've convinced myself to do it. The only problem is, Josh, and I know everyone out there listening right now is just cracking up at the notion of this happening, because no, I don't have any other ink on my body. But the problem is, with this tattoo, unlike all the others, those could be fairly small, fairly contained.
Oh,
this
boy.
One, to work,
oh,
would
boy.
Have to be fairly sizable. So
it's a
I just
map.
Don't know.
From the Lord of the Rings movies, isn't it?
From
a Tolkien map.
From actually The Hobbit. You've pegged me, Josh. You know me so well. No, I'll try to say this, and I don't know if this makes sense, but I did not seek out a number one pick that would be the perfect culmination for my list. But I had a number one pick that turned out to be the perfect culmination for my list. So in other words, it was obviously my number one before I consciously knew why it was. And it's inspired by the great James Marsh documentary, Man on Wire, about Philippe Petit, who famously strung a high wire between the two towers of the World Trade Center in 1974 and walked across the wire. So you've got, Josh, my theme of confronting your mortality. How about clandestinely pulling off the string of the high wire that obviously highly illegal? He found a way to do it. And then successfully walking across it 1,300 feet above the streets of New York City without a net. He's not just confronting mortality, it's walking up to death and punching it in the face. Those are stakes when you go out on that wire. I've talked throughout my picks here about the sensibility of an artist. Here you've got an artist whose canvas is the sky, whose brushes are his body. He's creating a wholly unique, never sadly to be replicated, work of art, an act of consequence, like Roy Batty describes, that isn't just extraordinary, though, it's sublime. It's an achievement that demands, it requires perfection, and in the act of doing it, displays perfection. And that image alone, I'm thinking of the one that is the cover poster for the movie Man on Wire. It's just so beautiful and awe-inspiring. It's Petit in black on the wire, almost like a dot in the distance, because we do have to have the sense of scale where he is up in the sky near the clouds, and you can see the two towers that he's walking between. Just that image alone is enough for it to be my number one when you combine it with the themes I discuss. But then, Josh, I get to pull a little bit of a Larson cheat here. I get to make it even better by combining it with a line of dialogue from another one of my favorite movies.
Uh-huh.
All That Jazz. Bob Fosse's alter ego, Joe Gideon, says at one point in All That Jazz, "To be on the wire is life. The rest is waiting." How perfect is that?
Are you putting the text on there, too?
I'm going to put the text on there, too. I don't know if I'm going to put the whole phrase, "the rest is waiting," probably. But definitely, "to be on the wire is life." That has to be there, because that's the All That Jazz reference. Fosse, like Petit, is an artist focused on perfection, trying to achieve the sublime. That's what that film is all about. In his mind, he's always coming up short. That's what we see again and again in that film, which is coming out in a Blu-ray edition on Criterion here in a couple months. Fosse, I think, would almost surely say, if he was still with us, that he never achieved anything like the sublime. Petit may be a little bit more confident, and of course he did pull off this amazing feat. He might say he did, but it's not like he hung it up after the World Trade Center. He still went on to do more. He continued the quest, but he certainly could have stopped after that. I think, Josh, for me, why this is my hands down number one and why I've almost talked myself into it is because they're the models. Making art as the only means to defy death in the exhilaration of the moment of the act itself, and in the art's ability to live on long after you're gone, which again gets back to that notion of permanence and impermanence that I think tattoos actually speak to. So maybe Le Samurai isn't my only aspirational tattoo. Man on Wire and All That Jazz, they really ultimately represent who I'd like to be. Don't think I'll ever be those guys. Don't have the courage, don't have the talent, but that is what I'm striving for and failing at every day. So for me, that sums it all up. That literally sums it all up.
So I see how this could work, too. I mean, you've got the figure of the man on the back of your neck.
Yeah.
The line running. You got
shoulders.
Stretch out. No, it's going all down both arms. So you've got to raise your two arms uh-huh. and walk around like that without a shirt. And then, you know, then the text will be on your back. It's a no-brainer. You got to do this. Should we go?
Well,
let's go.
Let's go right now. Just stop.
Just for yours.
Show's
though.
Over. Just for mine. You don't have the guts, do you, Josh? No, one thing I'm really hoping to get in our batch of feedback is I know we're going to get some responses. We're going to get some more pictures of listeners who actually have
some of their own
movie-related tattoos. We've already got, as we said, a bunch of great stuff that's come in. But I would love to hear from a tattoo artist who's out there, who's heard our picks, heard maybe our number ones, just even start with those number ones, and see what you come up with.
Try to talk us into it. Yeah. You know, there's something, you know, about getting a tattoo in college or that makes sense. I can even see getting a tattoo when I'm 70. There's just something really sad. I feel like getting a tattoo at 40.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to go driving around in a red convertible with it or something like that, too.
Well, I don't know if a Team Zissou tattoo really says midlife crisis, Josh. I think you're okay.
All right.
We'll see. Those are our top five movie tattoos that we might actually get if I can talk Josh into it. What about honorable mentions, Josh? Any others that you considered, or did you just max out at five?
You know, the other ones I thought about, let's see. I did think about Rear Window, which I cite as my favorite, best movie of all time. But I just couldn't land on the right image for that or text either. And the only other film that I considered was La Dolce Vita.
Yeah.
But, you know, Anita Ekberg got my biceps that we're back into topless mermaid territory. And like I said, not my style.
Well, I'll go with your Italian theme there. One for me that up until about an hour before we sat down here was in my top five. I was so sure it had to be on my list. It's Giulietta Messina's face from the end of Knights of Cabiria, the Fellini film. And I had all these notes about why I was going to go with it. It's the perfect summation of comedy and tragedy, and just all of life is there in her face. And then I ultimately realized that if it came down to Alain Delon and that cool factor, or the face of Fellini's wife somewhere on my body. I mean, I just thought about the fact that every time I was at the gym, every day I went, someone would say, "Hey, that's really sweet. Your mom.
Your mom.
You got a tattoo of your mom."
And you just say, "Yeah,
yeah,
we're close."
So, I'm sorry, Giulietta Messina. You are but an honorable mention only. A couple other ones. No Country for Old Men. The line I love, "What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?" It would be pretty freaky to have Anton Chigurh somewhere on your body.
You don't want to do that.
No, I don't. That's why it's an honorable mention. A Matter of Life and Death, the Paul Pressburger film, that amazing Stairway to Heaven image. That's another one, though, that would basically require a full body.
It's, yeah, a lot of space for that one.
Just an honorable mention. Twin Peaks. Maybe not so much the movie, even though I like the film, but I'm thinking of the TV series. That was another formative experience for me, and I love the Red Room, that checkered floor and the red curtains and the couch, I think. I just looked at this earlier today, and somehow now I'm forgetting the specifics, but I love it, and it's really kind of creepy, but in a cool way. I would consider that. I'd stay with David Lynch, Mulholland Drive. Think about all the times I praise meta movies here on the show and movies about the filmmaking process. I had to think of one, and this is the first one that popped into my mind, that had characters looking back at us, looking at a screen. In this case, they're looking at a production. It's when Betty and Rita are watching the song, the version of Crying by Roy Orbison, and we hear that line, Silencio. And finally, one I think you'd be on board with, Josh. It'd be a nice little small one you could get away with, too.
I'm running out of space here, Adam.
Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life.
Yeah.
That cover image, the foot in hand, gets back to my whole mortality theme, I think, nicely.
I don't think you gave enough thought to the likelihood of these turning out well.
No, I didn't.
Because some of these of like body parts and faces and that sort of thing, I've seen a lot of bad tattoos that sort of stuff. So the baby foot could be kind of creepy.
It could be.
The tree? Maybe the tree.
Okay. Well, please send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in limited release this weekend, opening here in Chicago, The German Doctor. From Argentina, the true story of an Argentine family who lived with the Nazi doctor Joseph Mengele without knowing his real identity. That sounds fascinating. At Facets, the cold lands. After a mother's death, a young boy disappears into the deep woods of upstate New York. And another one that's opening that does have some interest to us, Josh, I think it was in your top five of the summer movies. That's not at all a summer movie, but it just happens to be coming out in the summer months. It's Ida from my Summer of Love director, Poland's Pawlikowski. It's been getting a lot of really great reviews. Out in wide release, Blended. You know, when we think back on the all-time great screen pairings, Powell and Loy, Tracy and Hepburn, Sandler and Barrymore.
That's true.
Got to be
Michael
there, right?
Phillips never stops talking about those two.
It's got to be special. And also, the big movie, X-Men Days of Future Past. Next week on the show, Michael Phillips will be here with Josh. You guys are going to review the new X-Men film and share your top five movie teams. You sicking with that right now?
I think so. Yeah, okay. We're not sports teams. Other groups gathered towards a common goal. I don't know. We're playing with it. We'll see where it goes.
I like it.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and to the members of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. Also, special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week is from Chicago's Archie Powell and the Exports. Comes from the new album Back in Black. You heard the songs Holes and Tattoo My Brain appropriately.
Had to go with it.
More information is at archiepowell.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
I would like my keys.
Rupert Pupkin, you look the same, maybe 15 pounds heavier, but they say the average man gains a pound a year till he's about...
Oh, shit. I was to jump in.
You were so startled.
So stunned by your amazing work. Okay.
Oh, you know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to do that twice.
You know what? Let's go back and start over. Joe, we're going to start over. We're going to start over. Let's do the whole thing one more time. And I can't believe I'm giving you any direction here, Josh, but...
Yes, where was I amiss?
Only in, you sort of said the name like you were calling me that name as opposed to yourself.
Yeah, I'm trying
that
to think
name.
Of how does he say it. Let's just, we can't leave it out.
We could, but.
So, Rupert Pupkin.
Rupert Pupkin.
Okay.
You
got
look
it,
the
got
same,
it.
You know? Okay, here we go. And action.
Free as a bird, apparently. You go wherever you want with whomever. That much freedom could make you get that much free.
Yeah, see, and I think you butchered this line, too. Could maybe get a fella.
He talks super fast.
Yeah, he does.
All right, one more time.
And